All right, chapter 24 of the Confession of Faith of Marriage and Divorce. We're up to section 5. The last time we talked about forbidden degrees of marriage. This section is talking about two things. It's going to talk about the period of time prior to marriage. During the period of contract or betrothal, as well as after marriage. And what this section is concerned with are those causes which are sufficient to dissolve the bond of marriage. So I want to begin reading it first, section 5 of chapter 24. Adultery or fornication committed after a contract, being detected before marriage, giveth just occasion to the innocent party to dissolve that contract. In the case of adultery after marriage, it is lawful for the innocent party to sue out a divorce, and after the divorce to marry another as if the offending party were dead. If you notice, there's a distinction given. In the case of the marriage contract, we are given the option of adultery or fornication. That really is referring to whether or not the other party is in a married state or not when this occurs. So that being detected before marriage gives the innocent party the right to dissolve the contract. There are a number of things, and we're going to talk about this in more detail, but if this is exactly why going into marriage it is required that both people be virginal. And if you're not, there's a just reason to dissolve the contract. There is a good reason. If you understand what Paul is saying about being joined to other people for dissolving the contract, it is an adulterating of any marriage that you enter into. And so the innocent party is well within their right. They have just occasion. Now, there are some things that I think we need to look at when we go through this. And that is, there's a presumption here that when you have contracted to marry, you are nearly married. And it takes something very serious to dissolve that contract. It's not dissolvable for any whim or reason whatsoever. There's a contract that's been made. There's an oath that's been taken. And so to break that oath is really to invite the curse of God upon the person who breaks that bond, unless there's a just occasion. The very fact that we have to talk about a just occasion is because we're talking first and foremost here about the power and bond of an oath. When there's a commitment, as the confession calls it here, it's a contract. Betrothal is a contract. Contract carries with it an obligation to be fulfilled on the part of both parties. And that can only be dissolved, interestingly enough, as they point out here, it's really only going to be dissolved by something as severe as we're going to see is severe enough to break a marriage bond once that bond has been consummated. So you've got to look at this and understand that fornication or adultery is joining yourself to another person other than the one that you've committed yourself to be married unto. As Paul says, you know, the one who fornicates becomes one with the harlot. And so there's a one fleshness that occurs. You become one with every person with whom you fornicate or with whom you commit adultery. You form a bond that will remain. At some level, it will remain. It's an indelible mark, which is why women who continue to commit fornication develop what is called the whore's forehead. They begin to reflect a hardness toward men in general. There is a hardness that is taken on that is a mark. There's a difference between women who are only going to be with one man and women who are not. And that's a mark that will stay with them. It's a permanent mark. And so, when you're talking about this contract, it's a very serious thing to find out that one party has fornicated or committed adultery.
Say you're a spouse to some person, and though they didn't fornicate while they were with you, whether it was, you know, in marriage or espousal, would past previous fornications be enough to avoid that espousal contract?
Yes.
So if you found out that she says one day, like, oh, well, by the way, I'm not a virgin, you can say, see ya.
I'm not sure what that meant, but
right. Like, you're dating some girl and you want to get married, and you know,
you shouldn't be dating any girls.
What? Well, okay. Wrong words.
Yeah.
You're espoused to a woman, and she says, "Oh, by the way, I, you know, back in my teenage years, I was a fornicator."
Yeah, that is sufficient ground. If you find out, you know, after you've formed this contract, you find this out, this is sufficient ground to break the contract.
Is it, does that forbid marriage though? If it's okay, like if you don't mind it, like if you say, well, that was a long time ago, and if you repented, is that a bar to continuing
in the course of marriage? Well, I will tell you this: the idea that you don't mind it is already a problem. If you say you don't mind it,
wrong choice of words.
Okay, all right. There's already an issue here. Not minding it is indicating that you yourself are already hardened to this, right? If you don't find it reprehensible, then you don't have a proper perspective. And that in and of itself should be cause of concern for everyone involved. The fact is, it does present it is a just occasion, right? The confession is not saying when this fornication or adultery, well, it does say after a contract, being detected before marriage. The presumption, of course, is that there's been full disclosure before a contract, okay? Because if that has not gone on, that's going to cause probably irreparable damage when it does come to light, and it will come to light almost certainly. Right? It's not something you can keep hidden forever.
But what about if she says, you know, this is something I did a long time ago and I've repented? Is that still a bar from marrying her if she is repented of it?
I wouldn't say it's a bar, but it should be a very high hurdle and caution. On either side. I mean, you know, I would say this goes either way. right, when you're considering. And now we're at the point where we're considering contracting of marriage. Right? Contracting of marriage, you know, you're not to be unequally yoked. And so, you know, there's an unequal yoking when you've got one person who's virginal and somebody who's not. It's very, very unequal yoke. The problem is that people who are not tend to be very jaded in their view and think that they're, you know, they tend to think they've done nothing wrong. You know, they don't, and I mean, it's kind of funny because, funny in an ironic way, not in a humorous way, that on the one hand, they are pretty brazen, at least they have been at one point in their lives about what they're doing, and yet on another level, they seek to keep it secret, at least from some people. And so they know that there's something wrong with what they're doing. You know, there's no doubt that they know or should know that there's something wrong with what they're doing. And if they don't know, it's even worse. But the whole prospect here brings destruction into a marriage. You have to think about fornication is something, adultery is something that brings a wrecking ball into a marriage. If you contract it knowingly, you're bringing a wrecking ball into your marriage knowingly. And if you don't know, and you find out after you've entered into this contract, you know, there's been a betrayal, right? So there's a presumption here that, you know, you've had at least full disclosure before making the contract, and if you haven't had that, then, you know, it's going to make it even worse. All right, it's going to be a much worse situation. So it's bad. It's really bad. But it's even worse, you know, once you've contracted and then you find out. And, you know, it can be, it's not just a matter of, you know, suppose you understand somebody fornicated at one time, it was a long time ago, then you find out, well, it wasn't really that long ago. Right? You know, those are things that are destructive. Yeah.
Is it destructive because, like you said, at some level, the adulterator is still, the adulterer is still connected with
it
some
adulterates
other person?
It adulterates all future relations.
So there's still that always pulling that person back to the other person.
There could be a longing for someone else. There are expectations which are created, many of which are wicked expectations. Everything is twisted and contorted by these relations. So that's why, I mean, they're saying, look, this is a good reason to stop. You know, you've contracted a marriage and you find out now this is what's happened. This is a good reason to say stop. All right? That's it. The second question is after marriage. And we're going to talk about this as well. Adultery is the lawful reason for the innocent party. And I want to emphasize that. We're going to talk about that more. But the innocent party can sue out divorce. You know, adultery does not give the guilty party the right to divorce. It gives the innocent party the right to divorce should that person decide to exercise that right. Now, there's a real question here as Christians, should we exercise that right? Right. I mean, we're called to peace. We're called to resolve these issues. We're called to to do what we can to be at peace and bring about reconciliation, if possible. We're called to forgive. That's a different question. We're talking now about the right. And we have to remember, you know, a lot of times we have rights, but wisdom is not always standing on every right that you have. In fact, what is the best thing to do is not always standing on every right that you have. You may have a lot of rights, but very often you're better off curtailing your rights, hemming in your rights. You know, people go too far. We get too close to the edge. It's better that you voluntarily hem in your rights. And so we'll talk about that a little bit when we get to that question. The final question here is the issue of marriage after divorce. And we're going to be dealing with this in this section, and in the next section we'll be dealing with divorce in more detail, because adultery is not the only reason for a lawful divorce, but it is the most prominent and it is the most presumptive. The other reason that we'll see in the next section is a willful desertion that's beyond remedy. I would argue that to a certain extent there is a presumption there of adultery. At some point, usually people don't simply leave to be on their own. They leave to go to be with someone else. Right? And there are those situations where the guilty will be the ones who initiate the divorce, precisely because the church is so weak and the state does nothing to enforce marriage contract now. Okay, so the guilty will very often be able to sue out a divorce. That is absolutely unjust. That's allowing the person who committed the crime to decide the punishment.
So, break of a marriage vow that is unlawful, an unlawful break of the marriage vow would be punishable by both the church and the magistrate?
Yes, should be. All right, after divorce, though, the innocent party is the one that's allowed to marry another as if the offending party were dead. The confession is remarkably silent on whether or not the guilty party can remarry. In fact, the position that the Church of Scotland took was that in time they would allow the guilty party to remarry to avoid more disorder in society. However, it was almost unheard of that the church would even touch it to solemnize that wedding. They just wouldn't do it. If it was the innocent party, that's different. All right. If it's the case of widow or widower, that's different. And, you know, we've already touched upon till death do us part a little bit, but we're now dealing with the issue of divorce.
When you say that it's thought that in time they would allow them to remarry, but in most cases the church wouldn't touch it, you're just that in the cases where the church would allow it, the church would re-solemnize if the person could even find
marriage is not a sacrament. It's a civil contract.
Right.
Okay? So the church would, in time, receive the guilty party to repentance. Mm-hmm. And they would tolerate the remarriage of that party, except in case you cannot ever marry the person with whom you committed adultery. They would never allow that.
But I get my question is in the case where the person the sin has been committed, and let's say the guy shows up and he's repentant, the church. Understanding.
After a period of time, they would receive him again into communicant membership, repentantly, but they would not generally, from what I understand, they would not allow them to have, you know, a formal wedding that involved the approbation of the church.
But the church, would the church be involved at all then in that sort of second marriage?
I think it was viewed mainly as a toleration to prevent further disorder.
Wow, okay.
I mean, basically, what if you read the Reformers, they basically say that when marriages break up because of adultery, if the state had done their job and executed the adulterer, we wouldn't have to deal with this issue of the guilty party remarrying. All right, we just wouldn't have to do that. Right. So it's a situation we have to deal with because the state doesn't do its job. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, every case of adultery demanded the death penalty, particularly when there was no divorce. Right? I mean, you know, to a certain extent, both parties, both, you know, spouses have some say in that. And if the marriages remain intact, it's really hard to press for the death penalty in that kind of case. Okay, even if one marriage remains intact, it's kind of difficult to press that hard for that kind of penalty. But in notorious cases, and you know, you take into account, I mean, a death penalty was allowable, and for these gross and notorious cases where you have serial adulterers and all of that, they certainly wanted those people put to death. So, again, confessionally, we're really only talking about the innocent party having a right to remarry. Guilty parties don't really have a right to marriage. It is, as I say, a toleration that they allowed mainly because the state, in their mind, wasn't doing its job, and they didn't want further disorder by having these people unattached and fornicating and committing adultery with all kinds of other people. You know, because that's what tends to happen. You know, once people become promiscuous, they tend to remain that way. I mean, it's one of the most difficult sins to recover from, right? So it just tends to go from bad to worse. So what do we do in this situation? Well, you know, we have the case both for betrothal then and for marriage that are set forth. And those are the cases we're going to be talking about. And as I say, we'll be talking about the lawfulness of remarriage as well. That's a hotly contested issue, not just with the Roman Church, but which forbids it, but it is, in fact, hotly contested with certain Protestant groups like the Protestant Reformed Churches. They strongly reject the idea of remarriage unless you are a widow or widower, I believe. So any kind of marriage once contracted leaves you, in their mind, ineligible to marry, whether or not you're the innocent party, whether or not you know, you were deserted and had absolutely nothing to do with the dissolution of the marriage. In fact, if you become Protestant Reformed and you were divorced and remarried, they will make you separate in order to become a member of their communion. And that's caused some problems over the years for them. Caused a problem for a grandson of Herman Hoeksema, who was the founder of the Protestant Reformed Churches.
You're talking about the Dutch?
Dutch Reformed, yeah. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to that question. All right, question one. Do adultery or fornication committed after contract being detected before marriage give just occasion to the innocent party to dissolve the contract? The answer is yes. We're going to begin looking at Matthew 1, 18 to 20.
Matthew 1, 18 to 20. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise. When his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with a child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man, not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not, take unto me, unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Ghost.
So, when, you know, when Joseph detects that Mary's having a child, he knows that nothing has happened. And this is actually one of the reasons we know, by the way, that the period of betrothal is still a virginal state. You are going to be adulterating your marriage if you do not maintain that during your period of betrothal. Joseph detects this problem, she's pregnant, precisely because they have not yet come together. That is, they have not yet been married. Betrothal, espousal, is a period of chastity. It's not a period of uncleanness. And so that contract stands. But now we're told that Joseph is a just man and he seeks to put her away privily. You know, there's no injustice, the Bible tells us, in him wanting to dissolve that contract. And that's why we refer to this verse when we talk about this particular issue. We have highest authority that the contract was dissolvable once there was detection in that contract that there had been perhaps something which would have adulterated the marriage itself, having if they had come together. But the contract being espousal to marriage has its antiquity in the first ancient marriage of Adam and Eve. From the beginning, God established this pattern of first espousing. God brought Eve to the man on the first day they were created to see how he would like her, and upon the sight of her, by the wisdom that God gave him, he then took her to himself. Genesis 2, 22 and 23.
Genesis 2, 22 and 23. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man.
Yeah, we understand that that is him contracting to marry her. It's supposed to be a contract because it's very evident from the scriptures that Adam did not know Eve. That is, there was no sexual intimacy until after the fall. Look at Genesis 4, verse 1.
Genesis 4, verse 1. And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord.
Yeah, so sometime shortly thereafter, but it's clearly after the fall that this contract is consummated. So there's no consummation, really, of marriage prior to the fall. But there is a contract to marry. And man's fall into sin doesn't dissolve that contract. Right? Marriage is, therefore, it's not a sacrament. It is, as we've said from the beginning, this is an ordinance of nature. God created man and put him in this estate where he would, in fact, desire to be in this relation with another person, a woman. That God sets this up and brings the woman to the man. The man espouses her. But there is no marriage until after the fall. There is no consummation that would form the marriage bond. There's just, really, there's a commitment until that point. So that's what he's doing. So God really is the one who establishes this idea of espousal or betrothal. God is the one bringing the woman to the man. So if in fact, if it's objected that they are called man and wife in the time of innocency, it should be noted that those titles are used in Scripture, those who are only contracted to show the near and firm conjunction between parties espoused. Look at Deuteronomy 22, 23, and 24.
Deuteronomy 22, 23, and 24. If a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed unto an husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then he shall bring them both out unto the gate of that city, and he shall stone them with stones that they die. The damsel, because she cried not, being in the city, and the man, because he hath humbled his neighbor's wife, so thou shalt put away evil from among you.
Yeah, the fact is that the titles then of husband or wife, they belong to those who are espoused. They are already husband and wife. The marriage, however, has not yet been consummated. Right? But they are, in fact, in a bond that can only be broken by the detection of adultery or fornication. Nothing else gives you a right. You have an oath to go forward. And what this tells you, if this is the thing that can destroy the marital bond, sexual infidelity, then this is all the more reason the promiscuity in present culture should be detested and abhorred. It's destroying people, not only in the present, but it's destroying the future. It's destroying future marriage. It's destroying future families. It's sowing the seeds of destruction. And it is ingraining in your children the same sins. All right? They get passed on, the sins of the fathers.
So when a couple's betrothed, that's done with, of course, proper parental consent. And you're saying that they can be referred to as husband and wife at that point. If something does happen, let's say the man goes off and does something, or comes to light that prior he had done something, the woman is a virgin. Is her father allowed to step in and say this is a problem?
Yes.
So he's still involved up until the point that the marriage is officially...
Well, he's the enforcer of the oath. I mean, he's the one who confirmed the oath for her in particular. Parents both have confirmed the oath. Parents still can step in upon finding out and say, no can do. Gotcha. I'm not going to allow this.
Okay.
It was up to 24 hours, right? Or one day?
Yeah, it's just, you know, you what with the, well, upon finding out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, so, I mean, you can't respond to something you don't know. But you've got time once you've found out, which is why there has to be full disclosure.
Right.
Okay? You have to tell everything you've done in order to enter into a marriage contract, because parents have a right to consider all of that.
Yeah.
Okay? So you have to consider what it is you've done, because parents have to consider that. If you don't bring that to them, and they have an opportunity to consider that and hear out your side or whatever's happened, or what, you know, then there's not going to be any draining of that wound. And it's a very serious wound. All right? So, you know, you have to balance a lot of things. It's best that both parties be virgins. It's just simply the best thing. It's the safest thing. It's the best guarantee, you know, for success in marriage. Once someone is strayed, there's always going to be temptation. there's always going to be temptation that never would have been there. Right? That's just part of the way people are. And it's worse with men in some respects than it is with women. But it you know, I mean, there are things that we could talk about that's not, you know, it's not in the Bible per se, but when we start thinking about the nature of the transmission of sin, it's clearly through the male side, not through the female side. Otherwise, Christ would have been tainted, having taken upon himself the nature from the woman. Sins are sins of the fathers, not the sins of the mothers, that are being transmitted. Nonetheless, you know, there is a change. I mean, we have reason to believe that and understand now that you know, women retain biological material from every man that they've ever been with. Right? If they've ever been impregnated by them, whether abortion or whatever, that material remains in them for the rest of their lives. That DNA is in them. All right. Is that transmitted to children? I don't know. But it's in them. It changes them. All right. Their first experience is the experience by which they will judge every experience they ever have there from there forward. And it's important that that experience be within the bonds of marriage. If it's not, you've already trained men to go outside of marriage. You've trained them. You know.
Do you think this is maybe when we talk about adultery and what's going on with the children, you know, sort of the result and the trouble that follows, do you think this is why Solomon seems to have all this difficulty with women, even
yes.
being the wisest man alive? He's a child of Bathsheba.
Yes. He comes from an adulterous union, and he's going to struggle.
He does, yeah.
Yeah. And he's going to be made to face a lot of it. It's the sins of the father. The sins of his father were that, you know, he should never have married the woman, right? I mean, the church has been very, very adamant over the years of not allowing people who've committed adultery to marry one another. And it used to be when children were born out of wedlock, whatever the reason, they were put up for adoption. So that they were taken out of the situation that they were in. Mm-hmm. Almost without fail, they were given up for adoption. And that, I would say, that probably remains the best possible thing that could happen to this day.
Because by nature they're bastards, but by law they can be an actual...
Yes, by law they can be legitimized.
And then back to the idea that the idea that wisdom is not necessarily standing upon every right, we can probably even consider what Joseph's done there. He is allowed to divorce her, so to speak, I guess.
Yes.
And yet he doesn't.
He's minded to put her away privily.
Right.
Okay, he doesn't want to make a public example.
Right.
So he's not standing on every right that he has.
Yeah.
All right, but he's a righteous man, and that's going to be a disgrace. That will be a mark on him if she's having a child out of wedlock. You know, he needs that extra assurance because, you know, that's cuckolding when you're forced to raise someone else's child.
Right.
Like you've been cuckolded. All right. It's evident also in the case of Lot's daughters, who, though it's said that Lot had sons-in-law,
Genesis 19, verse 14, and Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, Up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. but he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law.
Yeah, and the who married his daughters, better rendered, who should marry his daughters. Yet his daughters were such as had not known man. Look at verse 8.
Just 19, verse 8. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as it is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof.
Yeah, so how does he have sons-in-law with his daughters still being virginal? The answer is they were betrothed. They were not yet, they were spoused, they were not yet actually married. And so it's most evident then the law puts a difference between a pure virgin and a spoused maid and a married wife. Look at Deuteronomy 22, verses 22 to 29.
Deuteronomy 22:22-29. If a man be found lying with a woman married to an husband, then they shall both of them die, both the man that lay with the woman and the woman. So shalt thou put away evil from Israel. If a damsel that is a virgin be betrothed unto a husband, and a man find her in the city and lie with her, then ye shall bring them both out unto the gate of that city, and ye shall stone them with stones that they die. The damsel, because she cried not, being in the city, and the man, because he hath humbled his neighbor's wife. So thou shalt put away evil from among you. But if a man find a betrothed damsel in the field, and the man force her and lie with her, then the man only that lay with her shall die. But unto the damsel thou shalt do nothing. There is in the damsel no sin worthy of death, for as when a man riseth against his neighbor and slayeth him, even so is this matter. He found her in the field, and the betrothed damsel cried, and there was none to save her. If a man find a damsel that is a virgin, which is not betrothed, and lay hold on her and lie with her, and they be found, then the man that lay with her shall give unto the damsel's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he hath humbled her. He may not put her away all his days.
So there's a difference. You know, and here's the thing. If you lay with your betrothed before you're married, you never, no matter what they do, you're never going to have the right of divorce. Right? You don't have the right. You have sacrificed any right to complain about what happens in the future. You have to remember, you taught the other person to commit adultery.
So this would also be the case then if the person you're marrying is willing to overlook some sin in the past, some, you know, fornicative something. If they, let's say 10 years down the road, were to commit adultery, have they foregone their right of divorce as well?
If the innocent party...
So if two people are engaged, yeah, and the innocent party finds out that the other person had not disclosed some very important thing, yes, and then 5-10 years into the marriage, whatever, the person who is the innocent party ends up committing adultery.
It probably has bearing on mitigating circumstances. You know, it's very hard for a bunch of people who are all fornicating and committing adultery to demand the death penalty for an adulterer when they themselves are guilty to varying degrees of the very thing. All right, it also I would think is going to be very hard to stand so hard on your right to divorce. And frankly, when we get to the next section, we're going to see the church has to sit in judgment of these things. And these are all things the church has to consider when it's adjudicating a divorce. You know, what was your past history? I mean, is this part of a broader pattern of history in your life? You know, is this an anomaly? Are the other parties involved? Is this a first time, or is this, again, a pattern of behavior for other people involved? All of that should be taken into account. Right? That's part of adjudicating. Mm-hmm.
So since marriage is an ordinance of nature, does the church only have the right to supervise divorce, or could, for instance, the state do it?
Oh, the state has a hand in it as well.
Okay.
You know, in a properly ordered society, okay. they would also be enforcing. But the church will be adjudicating it from a spiritual point of view, and then turning it over to the state for final disposition in a civil manner. Hmm. Okay, but the church has, you know, should have a first claim on this, because it is there is a spiritual dimension undoubtedly to, you know, families, particularly when you're dealing with believers. I mean, you're dealing with people in a nation professing to be Christian. You have to have the church looking at this and asking a lot of questions that are probably going to be very uncomfortable questions, but that because the church has to decide who's the innocent party here for going forward. I mean, if the innocent party, once they've decided all that, it's up to the state to enforce a decree of divorce if the innocent party. But the church could be involved, and the church may counsel the innocent party, don't divorce. On the other hand, they may find that the situation is so aggravated that they would say, you know, you should stand on your right. Right. There may be good reason to stand on your right.
Like if you find out that your partner was a serial adulterer behind your back, you might be able to say it's probably just better to cut ties, having learned this. It wasn't just like a one time, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there are a lot of possibilities. We could spend all day talking about possibilities. The reason why God appoints judges in cases is because judges have to take the law, and then they have to consider all the circumstances and try to apply the law equitably. You know, that's why I'm not a capital T theonomist, because I don't think that the law applies itself. I think it requires judges, and judges have a certain amount of discretion. Right? Judges have to make certain distinctions with regard to applying the law. You know, the law doesn't in every place discuss every point, and there may be things that come out. If you don't ask questions, if you don't sift the matter, it's going to be hard to know exactly, you know, how to apply anything. So the church may see a very good reason to counsel people, don't go that far. Don't push for the divorce. On the other hand, they might see a very good reason to tell them to push for the divorce. So I think it's important, in a well-functioning society, it would be important that these kinds of cases would come before the church first. The church is going to discipline, but the church can't divorce you. Right? They can discipline both parties, and they're going to deal with both parties as members of the church, and they have to decide, you know, if one party is actually innocent or both parties are guilty, and how guilty are they? You know, what degree has a line been crossed? So, with that in mind, I mean, we're really still talking about contracted, situations, marriage contracts here. All right, I'm just trying to show that there is this middling state. Contracted persons are in a middle degree between single persons and married persons. They're neither simply single nor actually married. So that's, they're really in this middle estate. And they don't have a right until the betrothal period comes to its end. They don't have a right to cross that line. Right? If they cross a line, they do it to their own detriment. They're taking fire into their bosom. They're going to bring destruction to their family. And to enter into a marriage, you know, from a betrothed state without confessing that is going to lead to even more trouble for them. Because it's an unlanced boil that will fester and will cause trouble in the future. They're going to see it. You know, what you do before you have children, in particular, affects your children. It will affect your children. What you do after you have children, that will affect them too, but not to the degree, not as radically as what you do before you have children. There is some sort of spiritual pseudogenetic aspect to the transmission of sin. Original sin is transmitted. And we are, in some sense, colored by the sins of our fathers. You know, the sins that they've done. If they're idolaters, before, you know, we're going to struggle with that. If they're whatever their big sins were that they were involved with, you know, when they before or when they have children, those are going to be to some extent transmitted. You know, they've done tests where they found that this is not just an illusion. There are, in fact, what we call family sins. And they've seen it's measurable, or they've actually studied this, and they see that these things are going on. Now they think it's all about nurture, but nurture doesn't explain enough. You know, nurture may be some, but nature is a lot of it. You are as you reach maturity, you're taking hold of your nature and you're forming it. And you're going to transmit that nature to children. Okay, so they're contracted persons that are in a middle degree, and it's important that they keep that in mind. To show that this custom of contract before marriage continued in God's church, it is expressly stated that Mary, the mother of our Lord, was contracted. Look at Luke 1:27.
Luke 1, verse 27, to a virgin espoused to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David, and the virgin's name was Mary.
All right, the contract being of such great import, there can be nothing to dissolve it but that which is sufficient to dissolve the actual marriage bond. Again, Matthew 1, 18 to 20.
Matthew 1, verses 18 through 20. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise, when as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Then Joseph, her husband, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privily. But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Ghost.
So, this is in the Bible, the contract period, the espousal period, is viewed as a very serious contract, and it leaves you in that middling state. You are, in a sense, husband and wife. You are in a position only to dissolve that marital bond that you've contracted to enter into. The only thing that's really sufficient is what can actually dissolve marriage itself, as we're going to see.
Does the death penalty apply to not just adulterers, but fornicators?
No.
No?
All right. Question 2. In case of adultery after marriage, is it lawful for the innocent party to sue out of divorce? The answer is yes. You get Matthew 5, 31 and 32.
Matthew 5, 31 and 32. It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery.
Yeah. So, adultery after marriage, again, I want to emphasize this, gives the innocent party the right. But a right is not an obligation to divorce. You have a right to divorce, but it's not an obligation to divorce. Same with the contract, the betrothal. You've got a right, you don't have an obligation. Now, the unbeliever, as we're going to see in the next section, the unbeliever, if one of the parties is an unbeliever, they could make it very easy, and they could just desert. And it could be such willful desertion that it's not going to be remediable. And we'll talk about that next time. But that's a different case. That's a situation where the unbeliever leaves. The innocent party doesn't simply have a right to leave or desert. They have to sue out a divorce. Right? There's no right to abandonment and create a state of estrangement. You've got to make a decision. You're either going to stand by the situation or you're not. Right? Again, this is to prevent. You can't have these kinds of things being litigated and going on like we let them go on for years and years. Right? It's unhealthy for everyone involved. It needs to be dealt with swiftly and needs to be dealt with in a manner that is absolute. Right? There just has to be a closing of that door. Right. So the sin has to be cut off, and everything has to go one way or the other. But it's to be noted that Matthew 5:32. If we look at that again, Matthew 5:32.
But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery.
Yeah, it says explicitly, anyone who contracts marriage with a person divorced for fornication, that is any kind of uncleanness, is guilty of adultery. Right? And I would go so far as to say this principle, to a certain degree, applies to people who are betrothed. When you have a situation where people are betrothed, right, the person who contracts a marriage with a person divorced for some kind of uncleanness, that person is guilty of adultery. So if you marry the guilty party, you are now guilty of adultery.
Whether the guilty party was actually married or just espoused?
Probably, yeah. If you look at that middling estate idea, it's pretty close. There is an uncleanness you're contracting.
It's just not as severe right. as an actual
marriage. Well, you've got a guilty party who's a covenant breaker, and you have defiled that person. You know, yeah. There are problems. So, look at Matthew 19:9.
And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, or shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whosoever marrieth her, which is put away, doth commit adultery.
Yes, Matthew 19:9 says, anyone who divorces his wife, except for fornication, and marries again, commits adultery. Okay, so, you know, if you divorce for all this idea, we're no longer compatible, for no-fault divorce. The fact is that you marry again, having divorced, even if you are, well, first of all, you're not really the innocent party. If you're divorcing for any reason other than adultery, fornication. Fornication just refers to any kind of uncleanness, sexual uncleanness, and so there could be something a little bit broader going on there. But if you divorce for any reason other than unchastity, really, in the other person, then and marry again, you are committing adultery.
You can't really divorce for desertion, correct? You can't initiate a divorce for saying you're
they've already the presumption. We'll get to that next time.
Okay.
The presumption is they've already initiated the divorce. Yeah. All right. But again, only the unbeliever is the only one who can desert. As a believer, you don't have a right to desert in a situation where you've got a mixed marriage. Hence, second marriage of the guilty party is sin. And the second marriage of a man who, though he's not guilty of adultery himself, has yet divorced his wife without proper cause, is also sin. Right? There's something wrong. So, you know, all of these divorce and remarriage situations that we have today are so many adulterous marriages for the most part.
So if you commit adultery and you get divorced, the slate has not been wiped clean. If you then go and get remarried under the pretense that, oh, everything's now set in order again, you're simply just committing adultery all over again.
Yeah, there's an adulterous nature to that marriage, which is why, although the church in Scotland tolerated it, they did so kind of spitting a bit, saying we wouldn't have this problem so much if the state would enforce the death penalty against adulterers.
So it's kind of like in the Old Testament where God would allow multiple marriages. Well, not multiple marriages, but you know, one man, multiple wives. It was tolerated in a sense,
yeah.
But it wasn't the ideal.
What should be the civil punishment for the party that breaks off the engagement bond or the marriage contract
before marriage?
Assuming it's this,
yeah. They're.
Or I shouldn't say in every case. Like, okay, what is the sort of top of the line punishment? Like,
well, the Bible. I don't know that it speaks specifically to that, but you have to consider that they're the guilty party, the one who broke.
Right.
And I think you have to question whether or not the church should allow them to marry with its recognition. That doesn't mean that at a certain point you shouldn't tolerate a marriage that they've entered into civilly for the sake of societal order to prevent further disorder from arising.
Okay.
But I don't know that the church should be so forward in giving blessings, you know, proclaiming blessings or even being seen to approve of this kind of behavior. So, I mean, if you're genuinely devout at any level, you would want the blessing of the church upon what you're undertaking. It's a very serious thing, and marriage itself needs to be redeemed.
But no death penalty in that situation because it's simply fornication and not adultery.
Well, it could be adultery if the other person is married.
Oh,
right. Or if the other person is unlawfully divorced.
Gotcha. Okay.
This is a mess.
Okay.
Yeah, this is probably
it's a very big mess. I mean, it's all kinds of confusion.
And this is why you're saying that there was this idea, although the church wouldn't necessarily marry them, but that these guilty parties should probably eventually.
If we're not going to put them to death, then, you know,
The problem needs to be contained.
We need to contain it a bit.
And this is also why I say we need judges to actually examine all the aspects of this case. Mm. Not just a cut and dry thing.
Yeah, that's true. It's not a cut and dry
thing. A lot of these are very difficult questions. I mean, some of them are clear. Right. You know, you have a guilty party and an innocent party. Mm. Sometimes you don't, though. You have two guilty parties. You know, and in that case, what do you do? You know, do you allow them to divorce? Well, you certainly don't allow them to divorce and marry the persons with whom they were committing adultery. That would be, like, rewarding that behavior. I mean, again, they were very clear about that. They wouldn't allow that. Right? That was just not an allowable thing. Okay, so question three, then. This is where we really get into the issue of remarriage. Is it lawful to marry a second wife after the first is dead? Yes. Look at Romans 7, 2 and 3.
Romans 7, verses 2 and 3. For the woman which hath her husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then if, while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man.
Okay, thus, so they err, deny the way to remarry to the surviving spouse. And there are those, by the way, who do. In the early church, there was a very large contingent of church fathers who frowned on remarrying if you were a widow or widower. Paul's very clear. If you're a widow, for example, and you're old enough to still bear children, in Timothy, he says, let the younger widows marry. You know, he wants them to marry. Right.
Mm-hmm. So they look down on that because of, like, didn't Augustine have some kind of worldview where it was like sex is almost like a bad kind of thing in a way, where it's like a lesser?
They viewed the marital estate as being, to a certain extent, a lesser vocation. Mm-hmm. Right.
Does that arise from the papacy?
No, the papacy inherits some of that view.
Okay.
But they don't. I mean, the papacy doesn't deny the right of remarrying to the surviving spouse. Some Anabaptist groups did. I don't know if they still do, but some of them did.
I'm sorry. I meant the idea that to be married is a lesser estate than.
Yeah, the papacy inherits that idea. They still have that idea.
Yeah, okay. So that wasn't something that originated from.
It would be wrong to marry your divorced spouse again because they're treated as dead, and you'd be marrying like a dead body.
Yeah, okay, so that's a different question, but right, the Bible forbids you if you've divorced someone, can you remarry that person? Yes, you can if that person has not remarried. But if that person is remarried, the Bible prohibits you to go back to that person. Right. They're confuted by the following. First of all, the apostle expressly says that a woman, when her husband is dead, is at liberty to be married. 1 Corinthians 7:39.
The wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. But if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord.
Yeah. If her husband be dead, she's at liberty, Paul says, to be married. So, you know, we're trying to get this out of the way before we get into the next question, but it's important to understand she's at liberty. There's a liberty there. She didn't have that liberty before. Now she does. What's the difference? Well, the husband is dead. Husband's dead, right to remarry. Paul calls it a liberty. And again, it's important to understand she has a right, but she doesn't have an obligation. Right? There's no obligation to remarry. And, you know, we can say that in reverse. There's a right, but not an obligation. A right does not constitute an obligation. Second, speaking of young widows, as I mentioned, Paul expressly enjoins remarriage. 1 Timothy 5:14.
1 Timothy 5, verse 14. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guard the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully.
Yeah, this verse, I think, actually goes to something we talked about earlier in this chapter. And that is, having children is really one of the great reasons for marriage. God instituted marriage so that there would be a legitimate seed, children. Right, so he tells younger widows to remarry and bear children. You know, if you are younger and you've been married, it's going to be very difficult to remain chaste. If you, this is a problem. If you fornicated, you're going to have a very difficult time. In fact, I would say it's nearly impossible. You should never be alone with someone of the opposite sex, because you're going to be without restraint. You'll have no restraint. You know, you shouldn't be with the opposite sex alone anyway until you're married, okay? And then only with your spouse. But Paul is enjoining remarriage in certain cases. He's saying this is more than just a liberty, but is something that is perhaps a little bit more pressing here. And it has to do with the fact he's dealing, remember, with the issue of widows that are going to be taken in to the number of the church and are going to be supported by the church. He doesn't want every widow to be thrown on the support of the church either. So younger widows ought to they ought to marry and bear children.
Wasn't there an age limit to be a widow?
60.
60?
At the time of the New Testament. Later on, the church changed that age. In the early church, they lowered that age a little bit. But Paul said 60. All right, third, husbands as well as wives have used this liberty. Look at Genesis 25:1.
Genesis 25:1. Then again, Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah.
Yeah, Sarah dies, and Abraham takes another wife. And Abraham although he has Ishmael with Hagar, that was sort of an odd imposition. Sarah kind of pushed that issue, trying to have children via her. Abraham is notably not only not an idolater, he's not a polygamist.
Idolater?
He's not an idolater, and he's not a polygamist. He's, you know, these things are connected in the Bible, adultery and idolatry. And he's neither. God calls him out. The father of the faithful is neither an idolater like his fathers had been, nor is he a polygamist, which is really an adulterer. You know, there was a certain stability that God tolerated for a time. Mm-hmm.
So since Sarah wanted to have children by Hagar, would they just adopt the children after Hagar had them? So that way it's Sarah's child by law?
That's what okay. They were. They would have been adopted. Yeah, that was okay. That was a way of adopting. Mm-hmm. All right. So we see then that this idea of marrying after death, that is biblical, and that leads us to the last question. And this is really where it gets controversial. Question 4: Is it lawful after divorce to marry another, as if the offending party were dead? Again, the answer is yes. I want to look at Romans 7:2-3 again.
Romans 7:2-3. For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then if, while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man.
Right. Thus do the papists and others are maintaining that after divorce, second marriages are not permitted to Christians. Why do we say that based upon that? Well, divorce occurs legally in the eyes of God only in very limited, circumscribed fashions. There are certain things that have to happen. One is there has to be adultery, or as we're going to see, willful desertion. Okay, but and we're going to talk about that just briefly today because of this, but we're really going to discuss it more next time. What happens? What happens when there is adultery? Is there's a destruction of that bond, that covenant. And it's up to the innocent party then to either uphold the destruction of that marital bond or to seek to reinstate that marital bond. All right? It's one or the other, which is why it can't be allowed to go on and be dragged out indefinitely. This is why, as we'll see, the church and the state both have something to say to this in the next section. The Roman Church says after divorce, second marriages are not permitted to Christians. Period. The Protestant Reformed churches take the same position. They will allow for divorce, but as long as the guilty party is alive, they will not allow remarriage. Now, here's how far they go. They had a case. This was Herman Hoeksema's granddaughter. I believe his granddaughter. She'd married a guy. Now, this guy had been married before. He had married a woman who, it turns out, was actually still married to someone else. Okay? So, that somehow, I guess they were in different states or something, somehow she manages to get married a second time to this guy. Okay? I don't want to name who it is. But if anybody hears this and knows, if they know the story, they'll know who it is. But and I may not have all the facts exactly right, but it's something like this. There is this second marriage. She's still married. She's not even divorced from this other person. Of course, when he finds out, the marriage is then annulled or dissolved, or I don't even know if you have to get a divorce when you're in a state of, it's bigamy. It's illegal. It's not even legal. All right? So he goes on then to marry the granddaughter, I believe it was, of Herman Hoeksema. They're not allowed to be in the Protestant Reformed churches because he was once married. And I had a very long discussion one time with, I think, two different Protestant Reformed ministers, trying to understand how a guy who was entirely innocent, she lied to him, roped him into a situation, it was bigamy, it was an illegal situation, it was a lie, how could they treat that? And their point is, they were married. And that marital bond is indissolvable as long as she's alive. And so this is an adulterous marriage. I think that's nonsense. So does our confession, thankfully. We have Protestant reformers who are smarter than Protestant reformers.
Quick question, just with regard to a situation like that, would the Protestant Reformed Church have advocated for the guy to get divorced in that situation? Or is the woman allowed to have two husbands because she roped her way into it?
I have no idea. I couldn't understand what they were... You know, you'd have to call them and ask them.
That much,
yeah. Okay, so But that's how extreme they went in this. And the Roman Church, the funny thing about the Roman Church is they take that extreme, but they also, and I think we may have alluded to this earlier in some of the earlier sections, they reserve to themselves the right to not only to annul a marriage and then treat it like it was not a marriage, but they also reserve to themselves the right to give dispensations of who can and cannot marry, even within forbidden degrees that we talked about in the last section. So the Roman Church actually claims a lot more right. The Protestant Reformed churches just say no. They don't claim the right to have this process of annulment. They don't see anything like that as legitimate.
So that's why something as extreme as annulment would be required according to the Roman Catholic Church. Because you have to
If you are going to be married in the Roman Church and you were previously married, that marriage has to be annulled. And usually what that means is you have to get a bunch of canon lawyers and pay a bunch of money to the Roman Church, and they'll figure out how to annul it.
And that's
Is like it's never happened. Even if you had children.
But even if you're divorced. Even if you're
You are divorced.
Right. The annulment's a separate thing to the divorce.
You are divorced. In the eyes of the state, you are divorced. But that means nothing to the Roman Church. It has to be annulled by the Roman Church. And once it's annulled, it's as if you were never married. Okay? So that's the kind of foolishness they fall into to have a second marriage. It's not really that the Roman Church prohibits second marriages. They just require a large down payment.
Yes.
Okay? We should be more concerned that we're only involving ourselves as a church with second marriages that involve innocent parties. Okay? That's a much more noble pursuit, I think. All right, they're confuted for the following reasons. One, because Christ permitted marriage after divorce. Look at Matthew 5, 31, 32, and Matthew 19, 9 again.
Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. It hath been said, whoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery.
Okay, so, you know, if we read very carefully what Jesus is saying, consider what he's saying. He's saying two things. First of all, he's acknowledging a right of divorce, and he's also acknowledging a right of remarriage. In Matthew 19, verse 9,
and I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery.
Right, so, you know, I suppose you can read that as if whosoever marrieth her that's put away for any cause, or even for adultery, is guilty. But I think you have to understand that he's speaking in terms that are modified by what he's already said. And that's certainly the way our reformers have understood it, even if the Protestant reformers haven't understood it that way. So here Christ, forbidding a man to put away his wife and marry another, in express words, accepts the case of fornication. And therefore he suffers a man to put away his wife in the case of fornication and to marry another. That's really what's going on. That's the argument that's going on here. So Christ is giving an allowance. Now remember, this is an allowance. Because going back to our first proposition, you have a right to dissolve the marital contract, but you don't have an obligation. So this is a right to remarry, but it's not an obligation. And it's only clearly a right to remarry, according to Christ. It's only clearly a right that pertains to those who are, in fact, the innocent party in a divorce that has been prosecuted for proper reason. Right. Second, because the apostle allows that if the unbelieving departs, the brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. 1 Corinthians 7:15.
1 Corinthians 7:15. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace.
Yeah, and so then if a brother or sister, when there's a willful and obstinate desertion, which we're going to talk about in more detail next time, is not under bondage, then surely the bond of marriage is dissolved. Right, that willful desertion, and we'll talk about that more. But if, you know, and this, all the remedies being tried in vain, we'll talk about that for bringing back the obstinate party. If the bond is dissolved, then we're at that proposition talked about in Romans 7:2-3. You're no longer under that obligation. The bond is dissolved. You're not under obligation. If there's no bondage, you can't be held to that any longer. All right? So if this is a case, I would say, where there's willful desertion, how much more when the case is put because adultery has, in fact, dissolved that bond? You know, neither the Roman Church nor the Protestant Reformed would deny that adultery is sufficient to dissolve the marital bond, at least at some level. Okay, they recognize the right of divorce. What they don't recognize is the right of remarriage, but if divorce is really a dissolution, as Jesus himself indicates in Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, if that is sufficient to dissolve that marital bond, then you have a right to remarry. Okay? Does it pertain to everyone? Jesus says no. Doesn't pertain to the guilty party. The guilty party doesn't have that right to remarry. Right. Again, it was tolerated, and I'm not going to go too far into trying to justify tolerating it, because I don't know that it is tolerable. But it was, and that's something the magistrate has to deal with, and eventually, if they're not going to deal with this in the way the Bible commends and commands, and when it comes to that point where it's shattering a marriage, then they're going to have to regularize it in some way and recognize it in some way. And then, you know, the church has to deal with this. The church can't simply keep people from reconciliation forever. Right? The church has an obligation to receive people who are genuinely penitent back into fellowship. Now, what do you do? Do you do what the Protestant Reformed churches do and say, well, you know, now you had a bad marriage and okay, but we have children now. In the second marriage, we have children. What do we do in this case? Do we break up the marriage? And you have to think about all of that. I mean, you could say, oh, well, we'll break up this marriage, but these people remain the parents of those children. You know, are they going to live in a relatively normal situation? You know, are you going to tell them they can't cohabitate any longer? You don't think this is going to cause other problems and temptations and so on, if they're genuinely penitent. So if this is a case, then, that the innocent party can marry another without blame, much more may the innocent party marry another when a divorce is obtained. You know, if there's a case where we allow this, where the Bible makes an allowance, where the guilty party's just deserted you, how much more when there's been a divorce a decree of divorce for just cause. Right, so that's really all we're going to talk about this week. Next time, I'm going to finish up, I believe, the chapter on marriage and divorce, and we'll talk more about that second reason that we haven't really talked about, the willful desertion. And we'll also talk about the place that the church and the state have to play in divorce. It's not, and really the gist of the next section is, it's not left up to individuals to decide whether or not they're going to be married or divorced. Right? It doesn't just fall to you as an individual. And that's the problem with fornicating, is you take it upon yourself to decide you're going to be married and then divorced from these people. Because you're really entering into a marital contract, not formally, but informally. You've married yourself to that other person, and you've taken it upon yourself, a prerogative that belonged to another. So you're, beside the fact that you're a wicked, foul fornicator, adulterer, or whatever, you're also someone who's cast off all authority. And that's what we're going to deal with in the next section, is that there is an authority in the church and in a civil society to regulate all of this.